Welcome back. I'm Julie Glenn. This is Gulf Coast Live. As of this week, the United States is halfway through Hispanic Heritage Month. The month is 30 days long, as expected, but it actually runs between 2 months, from mid-September to mid-October. It starts September 15th, because that's the shared Independence Day of five Latin American countries, Costa Rica, El Salvador, Guatemala, Honduras, and Nicaragua. And Mexico and Chile celebrate their independences in the following week. Francesco Masala Martinez is a Spanish professor at Florida Gulf Coast University. He was born and raised in Italy to an Italian father and an Ecuadorian mother. He began his post-secondary studies in Italy before spending some time in Ecuador and eventually coming to the U.S. to get his doctorate in Hispanic studies. Francesco sat down with us earlier this week to talk about the differences in pride Hispanics have while in their countries of origin versus when they arrive in the United States. That topic is the subject of his upcoming book, You Think, Therefore I Am, Constructing and Representing Identity in and Outside Ecuador.
So my research, it's called the critical discourse analysis, which means that I analyze discourse in the press, in novels, in movies, and I use the discourse in Spanish, of course, to understand how immigrants are represented in their countries and abroad.
So you're getting your start as a professor, but I mean, that's a really interesting course of study, and it really speaks to what we're talking about, which is it's Hispanic Heritage Month. Mm-hmm. But when I saw it's Hispanic Heritage Month, I immediately thought, well, Hispanic is more than one heritage to celebrate. So how do you see Hispanic collectively being represented in the United States?
That's a very good question. Of course, I was not born here in the United States, but when I moved here 5 years ago, that's when I first started hearing people would talk about this Spanish Heritage Month, and I was like, what is it? Like, why would people celebrate that? It was weird for me. It was weird, but it was nice to see how all of these different people from different Latin American countries would just gather for 1, 2, or 3 days and celebrate together. In many cases, we feel misrepresented. So not only underrepresented, but like we just feel misunderstood. Like we think that many Americans don't really understand who we are, what we are. They just think, you know, that talking about tacos or quesadillas, that just means talking about the entire Latin America. And that is not the case. That is not true at all. In the United States, I think that because we are a minority, we really like being together regardless. So here in Florida, for example, there are a lot of people from Puerto Rico. There are a lot of people from Cuba. And you cannot really see the difference when they talk or when they, you know, like they celebrate together, when they hang out. So I think it's nice to see that, because being a minority also implies that, you know, like you see the other as a friend and not as, you know, like that a different person. However, the perception that Americans has is kind of wrong. Like they should think about it more deeply and not just, you know, like gather like all of the different countries in one group.
We are talking about Hispanic Heritage Month. What does it mean to you? How are you and your family observing it? Give us a call at 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. On Facebook, we're at WGCU Public Media, and on Twitter, we're at WGCU using the hashtag GCL. Joining us in studio now is another Spanish professor here at FGCU, Eduardo Villarreal. Thank you for joining us.
Oh, no, thank you for inviting me.
So, Eduardo, like your colleague, you were born outside the U.S. Did you ever hear about Hispanic Heritage Month when you were in Mexico?
No, it was not something that we had a concept about or we even knew that was celebrated. Being from Mexico and from the close proximity to the border, we do have the concept of the Cinco de Mayo celebration that becomes very popular during that month, but not so much for the Hispanic Heritage Month.
Which every time Cinco de Mayo comes around, we're all reminded that it's really not that big of a deal in Mexico.
It has a significant for some people, it is significant, especially in the center of Mexico, in the city of Puebla, where a big fight, you know, against the French happened. But for us, is, or at least in Mexico, is more the concept that celebrating Cinco de Mayo for many is like they're talking about Mexican Independence Day. And that's not the case in that scenario. It's just a very important war that we had against the French. But it has no relation whatsoever to our independence.
It's been misconstrued a lot. So what does the term Hispanic mean to you?
Well, Hispanic basically comes from any person who is born in a Spanish-speaking country. So to differentiate from a Latino, a Latin American is someone who's born in the American continent from a Latin-speaking country. So, for example, to make a difference, a Brazilian is a Latino, but he's not a Hispanic because he's not from a Spanish-speaking country. So someone from Spain can be considered a Hispanic, but not a Latino because he's not from Latin America. So you can kind of put a little bit of separation into those two concepts of a Hispanic and a Latino.
So it's mainly a language-based designation.
It's kind of like the biggest way to differentiate it, yes. Mm-hmm. And geographically, of course, that anybody from Latin America, it's Latino.
Yeah. So now that you're in the U.S., do you notice some of what Francesco was saying about not only being underrepresented but sometimes misrepresented by being lumped together altogether in the Hispanic name?
Well, you have to take a lot of things into consideration. For example, I'm from a mid-high society in Mexico, so I cannot, you know, represent people that maybe grew up in the farms or in the south of Mexico. My level of education has been a little bit more, privileged in a way, because I've gone to private school, learned English since I was a kid. So we cannot all put ourselves in the same boat, because we have different experiences. We represent different type of societies in my case in Mexico. So the same goes when you start meeting people from Venezuela, from, you know, Chile, from Ecuador. You don't know what background they have, and you could just assume that all of us have the same culture behind us, or the same way we view the world, or the same way we can interact with each other. You know, you have to put a lot of things into play in order for you to just say we are all the same, or we all celebrate the same.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's all just it is just kind of boiled down to Hispanic Heritage Month. So when we're talking about putting all, there's so many very diverse cultures.
Correct.
That it's when you put them all under one name, does it create maybe a sense of camaraderie from Puerto Ricans to Costa Ricans and everybody in between?
Well, it's kind of like just you have something that is common in between us, which is the Spanish. Of course, and we can relate into communication, which is one of the most basic ways people get along is, well, if we understand
speaking
each other,
yeah,
you know, then we should be able to get along. But you have also other things that, you know, as the years go by, have differentiators. You know, we have to think about, you know, what type of history each country has had. There are some similarities in us. We have some countries that are more European than others, and you have still have some countries that have a little bit more indigenous background that are still very present. So you just have to kind of play along the lines that we're all trying to make, you know, the best into what we want to represent our countries. And then once we meet other people from other countries and get to know each other, it's just a cultural thing to make friends, to be a part of a group, to associate each other with, you know, with family type. So when you are in a country that is no longer your own, the first thing we want to find is family, or someone that is familiar to us.
You want to find that commonality. But then, I mean, is there a feeling once you're outside of your home country to want to also hold on to a lot of those cultural traditions that are not necessarily here?
Correct. You still want to be, you know, you. You don't want to lose yourself of identity. I mean, I'm sure that many people, you know, are proud of or where they're from and where they come from and where are they going. You know, I try to do my best, you know, to get into the American culture, but at the same time, I have to do it my way because I have all this background information that I have accumulated through years of studying or traveling or meeting people. But you still want to remain yourself, and at the same time, well, respect other cultures, try to assimilate them, try to integrate, try to be a productive part of it, but still not losing your essence.
Exactly. And then there's the chance meeting between maybe a Mexican from Monterey and a person from Mexico City. Would I be wrong to liken that to running into a fellow American in Europe, for example? It may be comforting in a foreign place, even though Alaska and Florida are pretty different. Do you think some of that camaraderie in the Mexican community, no matter what region you're from, has to do with a sense of relief almost, like a familiar face and a language that is easy to my ear that I understand from birth?
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those things that, of course, you're always going to have little rivalries in something, you know, like people from the city or the capital city, yeah. and people from the suburbs, like, oh, well, you know, the people from the capital city think that they're, because they're from the capital, blah, blah, blah. But at the end of the day, it's just little things that you poke at each other to make yourself connect, to make yourself, you know, lose those inhibitions, to make yourself, you know, be comfortable with little pokes like those, or if you want to call them little jokes, little pranks. And it's something that for example, I when I teach my students, is one of the most important things in Latin America that is very hard in the U.S. to conceive, is when you say hello to someone, you shake the hand, or if it's a woman, you give a kiss. And they're like, well, why do you give a kiss? Well, because you take away that personal space. There's no longer that personal space. So now we feel a little bit more comfortable. It's a little bit just easier to relate to each other, and we find more common grounds.
Yeah. When I talked to Francesco earlier, he highlighted some of the differences between some of the regions within Ecuador. Let's listen to that.
There are two main cities, Quito and Guayaquil. I grew up in Guayaquil, which is on the coast. But Quito, for example, there are a lot of indigenous people that live there, and that really influenced the culture of, you know, throughout the years, it really influenced the culture of Ecuadorians. So, for example, it's very typical to eat pig in Quito, but we will not eat pig in Guayaquil. We would eat fish all the time because, you know, that's what we have, like it's in front of us. So that's one of the differences. For example, the music is very different as well. We have things in common, you know, like the typical reggaeton music and all of that kind of stuff, especially within the younger generations. So that's very typical. But older generations, they kind of like try to create a difference between, you know, like people from the coast and people from the capital. Like they want to be different.
And they talk sometimes about those different rivalries from different parts of one country, which is within the greater Latin America and then Hispanic. So it gets down to a finer point. In Mexico, what are some of the things that people may not understand about the differences of different parts of Mexico? I mean, it's a big country.
Yeah, for sure. It's we're almost 100 million people. It's the largest Spanish-speaking country there is right now, and you do have to understand that there's different regions. Every region has a different dialect. Every region has had different influences from different groups as the years has gone by since the arrival from Europeans and pre-colonization, the indigenous groups that were settled there also still, you know, have a big influence on what's going on in those regions. If you go to the south, people might recognize names like Cancun, Playa del Carmen. Well, you know, you have the Maya influence over there. And there's a lot of things that want to remain untouched because, you know, it's important for the country. If you go to Mexico City, you have more the Olmecs and the Aztecs, and you still have a big representation of that language, which is the Nahuatl. It's still a 3 million people speak it today. You know, but it's something you cannot learn in school. You have to learn it with the people that speak that language. So those things always, you know, put different ways for people to grow up, to people to socialize. For example, in my city in Monterrey, we're more close to the United States. So a lot of things that we do are more attached to or similar to American culture. You know, we try to work a lot. We have a lot of factory, a lot of industry. You know, we don't have take many vacations. We try to always be, you know, the next step in technology or things like that. That maybe in other regions of Mexico is just not important. It's more about maybe, you know, living life, being part of the saving the ecological, you know, parts of the coast.
It's interesting how the priorities can be so different.
Yes.
From place to place, you know. And we are talking, if you're just joining the show, about Hispanic Heritage Month. What has been your experience like as a Latino in Southwest Florida? Give us a call and tell us your story at 877-428-8255. 8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. On Facebook, we're at WGCU Public Media. So when we're talking with Francesco, we talked about the influence of different indigenous cultures and the modern culture in a given country. And you mentioned that a little bit too. In Mexico, it's so geographically large and diverse, and there are different indigenous cultures that were there long before the Europeans arrived. There's the state of Oaxaca that's best known for its indigenous roots. It's even its name, Oaxaca, begins O-A-X, not what many people think of when they're thinking of Spanish. So what is Oaxaca like?
Well, Oaxaca is a very special place, if you want to put it into simple terms. So this is one of the regions in Mexico that is predominantly indigenous, right? And at the same time, it's a place that, because it is predominantly indigenous, not a lot of modernization has happened there. So, and it's in an area that has very rich natural resources. So the situation with these people since the 1990s about is that when we became into a more globalized society, resources start being more necessary. But you don't want to change the way people live just because you want to introduce modernization. So in this situation of Oaxaca, which is a beautiful country, it's a beautiful part of the country that has, you know, very typical pre-Hispanic way of life in a way, but it also has a lot of things that can help Mexico, you know, relieve from some lacking of economic situations that we might have. So there's always this interest in having them remain as they are, but then how can we also help them, help us, or that
kind of capitalize on that pristine environment?
Yes, because we want to have, you don't want to change their life, but they have resources that can change the rest of the country's life.
Oh, okay.
You know, so it's a very delicate subject. You know, there's a reason why there was a military group that grew up in arms against the government, because they wanted them, hey, leave them alone. They're not doing anything to anybody, so just let them be. But the government was like, well, yeah, but we need some of those resources to get out of our economic crash that we have in 1994. So it's always delicate. It's touchy subjects, of course. Depending on what position you stand on, you take your side. But in my personal point of view, as someone from Mexico, from the northern part, I believe that they should just, you know, be able to continue their lifestyle. You know, you don't have to find other ways. You know, we have no new technological methods. You have wind, you have water, etc., that we can maybe, you know, leave their area as it is.
And then I wanted to ask, we have a caller on the line. We have Hector, and Hector's in Marco. What would you like to say, Hector?
Oh, I just wanted to share with all of you that not only the Hispanic experience that occurs from the Hispanic countries, but also how sort of the identity of Hispanics changes here in the U.S. For example, I'm a first-generation born American, but of Cuban descent. My parents were political exiles. And even that, how that identity shifted and changes and melded with what American is, and sort of having one foot in one culture and one foot in the other culture, also adds to the whole experience.
Yeah, it is a different experience, I'm sure, to want to hold on to the Cuban traditions and then also embrace the American way of life is different. Thank you for sharing your experience, Hector. We also have a call coming in from Arturo. Arturo has a comment as well. What would you like to say?
Hey, I just wanted to follow up on what Hector just said regarding the whole experience of sort of being bicultural. When I was going to college in Austin, Texas, I really noticed that everybody from a Latin heritage just tended to gravitate towards one another and sort of find, like, shelter there in those groups. But I made it a point of sort of, like, moving away from that and really getting to know the people in the country that I was moving to. So that was one of the things. You know, of course, you will always, in your essence, be, I'm from Mexico, and you always keep that culture in you. You never refuse it or anything like that. But I think it's also really important to not just, you know, isolate yourself, but really immerse yourself into the American way of life.
It also presents kind of an opportunity to have the best of both worlds, both cultures, right? Arturo?
My wife is, can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you.
Yeah. my wife is an American, and it's always a very interesting dynamic because, you know, we have sets of friends that are Anglo, and we have sets of friends that are Latin from different countries, and it's really, if you really embrace it that way, it's really enriching more than anything else.
Yeah, well, thank you so much for your comments, Arturo.
My pleasure. Thank you.
We were talking a little bit about the Oaxacan situation, and I wanted to ask, because I'm curious still,
sure.
What kind of culture is it? I mean, what kind of foods do they eat? How are they different? How would you describe them as diverse from other regions of Mexico?
Well, it's just more original. You know, there's not so many things that have been modified. For example, I just have to compare it to my city where I grew up because it's my point of reference. So in my city, we have now, you know, a big influx of fast food, a big influx of, you know, multi-style of cuisines. You know, and in the people, when you live in Oaxaca, maybe that's just not available. You know, there is no interest in that. You know, you just keep your typical meals. You know, they eat their corn, they eat their tamales, you know, a lot of vegetables, things that are given by nature, you know, and not so much processed food, not so much sugars, things like this. I mean, that would be my opinion. I mean, I've traveled around Mexico. I haven't particularly been to Oaxaca yet. It's one of the areas I would like to visit. But
well, now I want to go because you talk about it so glowingly. Now I want to know what I'm going to eat when I go visit. It sounds like tamales, you said.
Yeah, it's what is the essence of Mexican cuisine. You know, there's a reason why the Mexican cuisine is almost represented worldwide. It has a lot of influence in a lot of other cuisines, or in a way, it's very similar. If you want to put it in another point, so we are a corn based type of country because it provides a lot of our nutrition, and we're meat eaters. We do cow, of course. You have deer, you have lamb, you know, in specific areas. So if you go to the coast, you're going to see that it's influenced by seafood and things like that. So, you know, each region provides its own kind of culinary experience, and Oaxaca is just a very traditional. You will eat insects that have, you know, a lot of spices to kind of just flavor them. And just a couple of weeks ago, I brought my students a little box of crickets that I want them to try. You know, and they were like, well, how would you eat this? And I'm like, well, you know, it's something that we just eat.
It's because, like chips.
Yeah.
It's a protein source. A friend of mine has a bug farm outside of Mexico City. So that is not that unusual for me to hear about. And, you know, food is such a big thing in all cultures. Have you had any experiences with food from different Hispanic cultures that really kind of opened your eyes to just how different the different cultures within the Hispanic world are?
Well, sometimes the meals might look the same. But the preparation, the ingredients that are used, the methods of cooking make food taste different. Sometimes it might be a way or a style or an ingredient that just makes it completely, you know, different than what you thought. Well, you know, this just looks like a sope, but it's a pupusa, and you're like, okay. It's like the same, but now once you eat it and you try it, it just doesn't have that same taste.
It's the same but different, right?
Exactly, yes.
Yeah. Well, we're going to have to leave it there, but I want to thank my guest, Eduardo Villarreal, I'm sorry, FGCU professor and men's soccer coach. Thanks for joining us today. I really hope you have a festive month celebrating Hispanic heritage.
Thank you. Gracias.
And usually at this point I say today's show is produced by Matt Smith. Well, this is the last day that I get to say that because he's leaving for a new job. So instead, I will say thank you to Matt and best wishes. Thank you for the past year, for producing this show with me, for making me laugh, keeping me on task, and overall just doing a great job. From all of us at WGCU, best wishes on your future ventures. This show was also produced by Rachel Iacovone. Our director is Richard Chin Cui. Our social media coordinator is Tara Callaghan. Gulf Coast Live is made possible through the generous support of the Elizabeth B. McGraw Foundation. For now, thanks for listening. I'm Julie Glenn. This is WGCU-FM Fort Myers, 90.1, WMKO Marco Island, 91.7 FM, NPR for Southwest Florida.